Hello everyone, and welcome to another edition of My Classic Album, the show where we look back on some of the greatest albums in music history. I'm Mike Norris, and thank you for tuning in. October has been a huge month for My Classic Album, not least because of our Battle of Hell episode that we did last month, dedicated to 40 years of one of the greatest albums. I mean, I personally would call it the greatest album of all time, but being that it's a podcast about classic albums, I suppose I should probably have a bit of objectivity and say it's one of the greatest of all time. And some of the feedback that we've got from this episode was just absolutely... It's always lovely to get feedback, but it was particularly nice. It shows us how passionate Meatloaf and Jim Steinman fans are about this album and about both their careers in general. Franz Mohart, in the middle of listening to the podcast, wrote on Facebook, "Loving it so far, in the middle of listening to Jacqueline Dylan, so full of warmth and passion and amazing stories. Truly, this is excellent." Andrew McIntyre said, "Really interesting to hear Jacqueline discussing the album and its impact." And at Matt Lee on Twitter said, "I love this episode of MCA Podcast, all about the utterly brilliant Battle of Hell album. Very informative and entertaining." And that feedback was all, as I say, just, it was just so lovely to hear. But arguably, and I'm sure that no one would have any problem with me saying this, the greatest feedback I had came from a very unexpected source. Now, anyone who listened to the podcast will have heard Jacqueline talk about her working relationship and friendship with Jim Steinman. And, you know, as I was getting the episode put together and getting everything going, she would often say things like, "Oh, Jim will be thrilled, Jim will really enjoy it." And there was a part of me, I must confess, that thought, well, is he going to get the time to listen to it? You know, he's a busy man, the musical's going. And even if he did, you know, how would I ever know how he felt about it? And I woke up one morning to a lovely message from Jacqueline, who was relaying a message from Jim himself. And it said, "Thanks to you, Mike Norris, for the time, attention to detail and great taste necessary to rank Bat Out of Hell your classic album." He then went on to address all of the fans of Bat and Jim's illustrious career. "I don't take their attention, love, respect or devotion lightly. They mean so much to me and all feelings are mutual. Songs by Jim Steinman are nothing without the greatest audience and most epic fans ever in the history of music." And to get that, you know, I've listened to Meatloaf for a long time, just as I have Queen, who are our topic for this episode of My Classic Album. So to get that kind of feedback from Jim Steinman, who, you know, this album was kind of birthed from his extremely creative mind. So it was amazing to hear his feedback on it. So thank you very much, Jim, for taking the time to listen to our podcast and to let me know what you thought of it. And thanks to everyone who listened to the podcast, enjoyed it. And it's still up there. It's still up on myclassicalbum.co.uk. It's still on Apple Podcasts. We're now recently gone on Stitcher. TuneIn, all sorts of different places where you can get My Classic Album. And that episode, 40 Years of Battle of Hell, as well as all of our other episodes, are still there, ready for your listening pleasure. And that, if I do say so myself, is the perfect segue into what I wanted to talk about next. So 2017 has been a huge year for My Classic Album. It's the first full year of the podcast, so we launched in August 2016. And we've covered some great albums and had some phenomenal guests. I think if you told me at the beginning of the year some of the people that we'd be talking to on the show, I probably wouldn't have believed you. So I think it's really a testament to all of you guys who are listening. It makes it worth doing, you know, like I do this for me and I love it, but there's something great about getting your feedback and hearing from you guys after every episode and letting me know what you think. So it got me thinking, which album that we've covered in the past year would be your My Classic Album of the year? So I'm going to do this from December last year, simply because we can't cover December this year. So we're going to do it from December last year. So that was Adrian Nation talking about Time Out of Mind by Bob Dylan, right through to this month, which is Sheer Heart Attack by Queen, as chosen by Greg Hart from Cats in Space, and all the episodes in between. So I'm going to put something on in a little bit that'll just be a reminder of all the episodes that we've had and all the guests. And then if you want to head over, if you feel so inclined, to myclassicalbum.co.uk or to our Facebook page, just search for My Classic Album with Mike Norris and you'll find that quite easily. And there's two questions. The first one is, out of all those albums that we've covered throughout 2017 and admittedly the back end of 2016, which would you name your classic album of 2017? So take your time, maybe have a listen to the albums again, maybe listen to the episodes again, and make your choice. Which of those albums, and there'll be a reminder as I say in a little bit, would be your classic album of the year? The second question, which again I would love you all to answer, just to give me an idea of kind of which episodes you've enjoyed the most, which of the guests that we've had on My Classic Album do you feel gave the best argument for why their album is such a classic album? So, you know, maybe you thought Jacqueline Dillon gave an absolutely phenomenal argument as to why Battered to Hell is the greatest album of all time. Maybe you thought Nathan Stevens Griffin, who did The Queen Is Dead by The Smiths in January, maybe you thought Nathan gave a really strong argument as to why The Queen Is Dead is the greatest album of all time. So again, might be worth going back and listening to the podcasts if you've got the time and you fancy going back. So that poll is up on myclassicalbum.co.uk/poll. And of course, on our Facebook page, My Classic Album with Mike Norris. So in case you're casting your brain back, trying to remember all the albums that we've covered this year, here's a reminder of our classic albums of 2017. Which of our classic albums should be named My Classic Album of the Year 2017? Here's a reminder of some of the great albums we've covered over the past 12 months. In December last year, I was joined by Adrian Nation to discuss Bob Dylan's resurgence to critical acclaim, 1997's Time Out of Mind.
It's one of those albums that the whole album is kind of a sort of an unrequited love theme that runs right the way through it. It puts love into the place it should be, which is preeminent in our life.
Nathan Stevens Griffin of DIY pop band Martha joined me in January to chat about the Smiths' defining album, The Queen Is Dead.
What album would you do if you were going to do a podcast? And the one I just kept coming back to was The Smiths, because it kind of was something that really spoke to me then, as I think a lot of people feel, especially if they're a bit weird.
We celebrated 40 years of Rumours back in February with Neil O'Donoghue, the webmaster of Fleetwood Mac fan site Go Your Own Way.
It's a rollercoaster of an album from an emotional perspective as well. You hear peaks, you hear the rocky songs, you hear the softer songs. That keeps me as a listener aware, it keeps me interested. And I very much enjoy listening to it when I did it originally, but continue to listen to it to this day.
Singer-songwriter Samantha Price chose her classic album back in March, Joni Mitchell's deeply personal Blue.
I think it's one of the most inspiring albums from not just an emotional standpoint, but from just the amount of, you know, creativity and talent that she possesses.
April saw Grammy Award-winning Bruce Carroll join the show to chat about his classic album, James Taylor's Sweet Baby James.
The mellow singer-songwriter, writing from the heart, writing what we were feeling, the record just gathered all of us into a place of, you know, realizing that somebody is writing the music of our lives.
Music fan and owner of Inner Groove Records, Ben Dumbreck, joined the podcast in May to chat about the critically acclaimed debut album from Arctic Monkeys, Whatever People Say I Am, That's What I'm Not.
If you've never heard it before, you will hear it and it's talking to you. You will hear it and you will go, oh, I remember. So it transports you back, and there's not an awful lot of albums that actually do that.
Hard rock singer and guitarist Beth Blade took time away from her Beautiful Disasters to sit down with me to chat about Kiss's difficult second album, Hotter Than Hell.
When I write songs, I'm a very riff-orientated person, and when you listen to the riffs on Hotter Than Hell, some of them are just absolutely outstanding and they don't get the credit that they deserve for, because I am so influenced by it. This music is inside of me and I couldn't not be influenced by it if I tried.
Esther O'Connor is one half of Scottish country duo Ashton Lane, and she joined me in July to talk about Carole King's hugely successful Tapestry.
It is a masterclass in songwriting. It's an album with continuity, so, you know, all the way through it doesn't jar, it doesn't, you know, there's not like nothing seems out of place for me. It's seamless, an absolutely seamless Tapestry.
Tiger Tales and Midnight City frontman Rob Wild joined the podcast in August to help us celebrate 30 years of Def Leppard's Hysteria.
Nothing could beat this. I don't think any album will ever come along for me personally that will be a better sounding album and a better album, you know, songwriting wise. I think it's just genius. It really is.
And later that month, River Dogs drummer Mark Danzeisen sat down with me to chat about Stevie Wonder's Grammy Award-winning, but perhaps underrated, Fulfillingness's first finale.
He'll write these melodies, and a percentage of it is his melodies are just staggering, you know, because of his influences, you know, his jazz influences, his soul, his gospel influences, his Latin influences. Everything just comes together, and he's able to do that.
Critically acclaimed blues singer Big Boy Bloater joined My Classic Album in September, and his chosen album was Blondie's Parallel Lines.
It's an album that I grew up with, and it was just all through my teen years I was listening to it, and still today I listen to it, so I think it's one of those albums. It sounded great then, and it sounded great now. It just seems to have stood the test of time with me anyway, so yeah, it's a real classic for me.
Last month saw Meat Loaf's Bat Outta Hell reach 40 years old, and to celebrate, I was joined by Jacqueline Dillon to talk about the album.
I think it stands alone as the classic album of generations. I don't think there's ever been an album ever made, and I doubt there will ever be an album made again that so eloquently speaks for human beings.
And of course this month, Cats in Space guitarist Greg Hart has sat down with me to chat about Queen's Sheer Heart Attack.
You just don't do that. You just don't take Freddie's fingers off the piano. You just don't do this. Outrageous behaviour. I couldn't do it. I'd feel if I did it here, 100 people would run up my stairs and, aha, we've caught you, you do that, you know. But no, you don't touch Freddie's fingers when you're on the piano. Oh, no, dear.
To vote for the album that you think should be My Classic Album of 2017, head to the My Classic Album Facebook page or to www.myclassicalbum.co.uk/poll. So my guest in just a few minutes will be Greg Hart from Cats in Space, who has chosen, coincidentally, my favourite Queen album, which is Sheer Heart Attack. And, it's so much fun chatting to a fellow Queen fan. So that interview is coming up in just a little bit. Now, anyone who looked on the Facebook page at any point this month will have seen that I was torn between a few albums, like current albums, that I wanted to talk about on the podcast this month. So I was stuck between Liam Gallagher's new album, As You Were, Foo Fighters' Concrete and Gold, The Darkness, Pinewood Smile, and the album that I eventually went with, Judas by Fozzy. Now, I love Foo Fighters, and I love The Darkness, but the reason that I put them in there is I thought that those albums would be, you know, for Queen fans who are listening, you know, they probably are big fans of The Darkness and Foo Fighters. The Foo Fighters and The Darkness are certainly huge fans of Queen. And Liam Gallagher, it's, you know, I didn't expect much from that album, because I always felt that Noel was the bigger part of Oasis than Liam. But, you know, actually, it's well worth listening to. I was pleasantly surprised. It is a really good album. But, you know, Ben Dumbreck, who joined me in May, as you just heard a couple of minutes ago, and I were having a bit of a chat on the Facebook page about Fozzy. A lot of people who listen to this may not have heard of Fozzy, and the reason that I'm doing this album review is maybe to change that a little bit. So Fozzy are fronted by WWE legend Chris Jericho, and they're just an awesome hard rock band. They are fantastic. And, I mean, the first time I saw them, they were playing in Middlesbrough in this little venue. And with each album, they're just kind of getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And you can hear that in the albums too. So it's not just that more people are listening to the albums. They're up in their game and they're working harder. When I first got into them, they had an album out, Chasing the Grail, which I would thoroughly recommend. It's an awesome album. They followed up with Sin and Bones a few years later. And then about 3 years ago, they released their previous album, Do You Want to Start a War? Which each album just seems to get more slick and polished, and they become more and more of an outfit as it goes on and gets really, really strong. So I think there was a lot of anticipation for Judas, and I think that has particularly been encapsulated by the single. So one thing that Fozzy kind of really needed to kind of get some momentum with this album was a strong hit single. In the US, it's not something that's really particularly been easy for them to come by. Judas is that single. So a few months ago, they released the music video. The video's pretty cool, but the song is fantastic. And if you like WWE, like, it's the sort of music that they used to use for, like, their pay-per-view themes. So, you know, about 15, 20 years ago, when it was WWF and everything was kind of flying high and they could do no wrong, there was very much this kind of hard rock and metal soundtrack to it. You know, WWE now, they kind of jump into R&B and stuff as well, which just isn't for me. But Judas is an absolutely, if you like hard rock and metal, it is an awesome, awesome track. And one of the criticisms I've heard in the past, and I'm not necessarily sure that I agree with it, is that people think that Chris Jericho can't sing. So, I mean, Chris Jericho, I did an interview earlier this month for The Podcaster's Life with Alexander Lurin, and he'd said to me, who's your podcasting hero? And my answer was Chris Jericho, because this guy's a professional wrestler, he's the lead singer of a rock band, he's an actor, he's an author, and he's a podcaster. He does everything, and he does it really, really well. One thing I will say is that I think his voice is a lot better on this album. I never particularly thought it was bad, but kind of the level that I thought he was a perfectly good singer, you know, he's kind of upped that again. And again, I think that is something that he has done as the albums have gone on, that his voice has gotten stronger and he's kind of settled into it more. I absolutely love Rich Ward, who was on guitar. I think he's phenomenal. I actually met the band a couple of years ago during their Do You Want to Start a War tour. And although it was great to meet Chris Jericho, it's always, you know, people say don't meet your heroes, but I mean, Jericho was cool. It was Rich Ward for me who left this real kind of lasting impression on me. So you may know him from bands like Stuck Mojo, who were kind of a big part of the new metal movement at the tail end of the 90s, and they're still around today. And so you can hear that new metal influence, you can hear that hard rock influence, and it all kind of comes together. Fozzy have described themselves in the past as the bastard child of Metallica and Journey, which is like a really good description of what they do. Standout tracks? Well, as we record this, the album's only been out for like a day or two. And so obviously Judas is sticking in my head. And, you know, if you're listening to this in America and you listen to kind of the hard rock stations and that, you will have heard Judas. It seems to be everywhere. I think Jericho said it was top 10 very recently, which is a phenomenal achievement for them. I think, you know, Wolves at Bay, which is the last track on the album, that's one thing that if you go back and listen to Fozzy albums, they're very good at openings and closings. You know, their first track and their last track are always kind of dynamite. And Wolves at Bay, which is the final track on the album, is fantastic. Words with Way is another fantastic one. And it's really, you know, that start is just really heavy and crunching. I think, you know, when you have a professional wrestler as the lead singer, you know, I love wrestling, so I'm not going to knock it. But I'm sure that there's some people that are like, oh, well, you know, he's a wrestler and he's singing. Like, absolutely check them out. They are really, really worth listening to. If you like Steel Panther, we reviewed Balls Out a few months ago, as I recall. And, you know, Steel Panther have toured a lot with Fozzy. Michael Starr was on the last album. You know, Steel Panther fans would probably really enjoy Fozzy as well. It's that kind of thing. I'm a big fan of Blackstone Cherry. I imagine there's a bit of bleed over there too, if you're into Blackstone Cherry. I was this close to reviewing their EP, Black and Blues. But I left it out simply because it's an EP. I may do like a YouTube video of it or something. Get that. I digress. I'm rambling a bit. But I can't recommend Judas enough if you are a fan of the band. And if you're not, this seems like a good opportunity to get on board. And just check out Judas. Check out Do You Want to Start a War as well, their previous album. Both fantastic albums. I mean, to be fair, their whole discography is excellent. And they're a very underrated band. They have a pretty strong touring presence here in the UK. You know, they come every couple of years and they draw big crowds to, like, the Academy and stuff like that. But this might be the one that kind of sends them over the top. And I really hope it is. So, yeah, Judas by Fozzy is out now, as are all the other albums that I described. There's been a really, really good month for albums. Concrete and Gold came out kind of middle of September by Foo Fighters. Well worth checking out. Liam Gallagher, As You Were. Again, very different to the likes of Fozzy, but if you're into that sort of thing, check it out. And then The Darkness' new album is awesome too, Pinewood Smile. And I think that's doing really well in the charts. So it's kind of cool to see all these rock bands kind of, you know, there seems to be a little bit of a resurgence going on. And then Blackstone Cherry with their EP, you know. Just buy Blackstone Cherry all the time. They're absolutely amazing. I'm determined to get some from Blackstone Cherry on the podcast one day because I want to hear where those influences come from because they're just, for me, they're just an amazing band. Right, so I think that's the end of the review. I think that kind of went into all sorts of different things, but, you know, hopefully that's a few albums that you want to check out. And, of course, Judas would be pretty high on the list, if not top. So my guest at this time, let's go back. You know, we're doing current music. Let's go back to 1974 and, in my opinion, the greatest album by, in my opinion, the greatest band to have ever set foot on this earth. Not that I'm biased. So we're talking about Sheer Heart Attack by Queen. It's their third album. And my guest Greg Hart from Cats in Space. And just a side note, if you enjoy Queen, you will love Cats in Space. And we'll talk more about them later on in the podcast. But Greg Hart, who is the guitarist from Cats in Space, has chosen this album. And before we get to him, let's just look back. Here's the beginning of what you need to know about Sheer Heart Attack. The 8th of November 1974 saw the release of Sheer Heart Attack, the third studio album by British rock band Queen. The album was released by Trident in a licensing deal with EMI, and much of the album was recorded at Trident Studios in London. Sheer Heart Attack was produced by Roy Thomas Baker, the third of five Queen albums that he would collaborate on with the band. Guitarist Brian May was sent home and hospitalised during a US tour with Motley Hoople, and thus the majority of Sheer Heart Attack had to be recorded in just 2 weeks. A double A-side of Killer Queen and Flick of the Wrist was the first single off the album, released on the 21st of October 1974 in the UK. It proved to be Queen's breakthrough moment, reaching number 2 in the UK singles charts and a respectable number 12 on the US Billboard Hot 100. Follow-up single Now I'm Here was released in the UK in January 1975, reaching number 11 on the singles charts. Both Killer Queen and Now I'm Here became mainstays in the band's live set throughout the 70s, and both tracks appear on Queen's Greatest Hits, released in 1981, as of recording, the best-selling album in UK history. Spurred on by the success of Killer Queen, Sheer Heart Attack itself reached number 2 on the UK album charts, and number 12 on the US Billboard 200. Those UK and US sales were enough to warrant a platinum certification in the UK for sales of over 300,000, and in the United States, a gold certification for sales of over 500,000. While sometimes overshadowed by Queen's follow-up, A Night at the Opera, Sheer Heart Attack is well-loved critically. Classic Rock magazine named it 28th of its 100 greatest British rock albums ever in 2006. In the same year, NME placed it 63rd on its greatest 100 albums of all time. Finally, it was Kerrang that pulled the album 8th in the 100 best British rock albums ever in 2005. So that's just the beginning of what we need to know about Sheer Heart Attack. And I have here with me my very special guest who chose the album to talk about today. From Cats in Space, this is Greg Hart. How's it going?
Hello there, Mike. How are you doing? It's all going well here. How's it going? You're in good?
Yeah, I'm great, thank you. And I just want to thank you before we get started for choosing a Queen album. So anyone who listens to the podcast knows that I'm a massive Queen fan. And if you listen to previous episodes, I often kind of drop in comparisons to Queen and all that sort of stuff. So,
right. It'll be... I didn't know that. This isn't a setup, folks. This is all genuine. it was a toss-up between two or three albums, to be honest. Two Queen albums in particular, and a Thin Lizzy album. But retrospect to, like, you know, when I was growing up and sort of the whole music thing sort of started for me, really, because Queen was pretty much the first sort of grown-up album band that I sort of purchased, you know, as a young kid, you know.
So Sheer Heart Attack is within what I believe is like an amazing run of albums for Queen over the space of 4 years. So you have Queen 2, Sheer Heart Attack, A Night at the Opera, A Day at the Races, News of the World. Some people would put Queen and maybe Jazz in either side, but they're all celebrated as classic albums by any standard, let alone Queen albums. What is it about Sheer Heart Attack for you that sets it above those other great Queen albums?
Well, the funny thing is, as just to touch on what you just said, it's this incredible body of work that Queen and other bands too, like Thin Lizzy, UFO, Rush, you know, all those sort of classic bands that I grew up listening to, they were churning out these albums of ridiculous quality from a period of about 4 years, you know, and touring as well. It staggers me. For me, what it was, I think, was I like Queen when they did Seven Seas of Rye, and my brother got the Queen 2 album, which is literally 1% for me behind Sheer Heart Attack. I mean, it is like trying to choose your favourite cat, you know, it's almost impossible. But I think Sheer Heart Attack just about nips it for me, probably because of where I was at that time. You know, I was like 11 years old. And by the time I listened to Queen 2, Sheer Heart Attack was coming out, and I heard Killer Queen. And Killer Queen was an absolute game changer for me, to see this crazy guy on a piano on Top of the Pops who looked, you know, camp as Christmas, and to do this song that had so much in it, and it's not even 3 minutes long, and I was, you know, even as an 11-year-old kid, I was amazed by it. So when the album came out, it was just like all these tracks. I mean, half the album's under 3 minutes long, you know, it's like all these little short tracks that they say so much, and it's the variant from, like, Flick of the Wrist, which is, you know, a monster track, and obviously Stone Cold Crazy, Brighton Rock, that storming heavy rock thing with those amazing Brian May guitars, and then they go and do, like, Bring Back That Leroy Brown, which is just genius. I mean, just the rhythm, you know, I always say to people that aren't massive Queen aficionados, just listen to John Deacon and Roger Taylor, ignore everything else, and try and just hone in on the rhythm. You know, it's just an album that you can play time and time again. For even 40 years on, I'm still marvelling at how they did the bloody thing, you know, and I'm, you know, Cats in Space obviously being a huge, huge influence on what I do as a writer, and myself and Mick Wilson when we get together, you know, and I try and do like the Brian May thing because I've always been into harmony guitars. It still staggers me how they did that back then, and even with today's technology, it's blooming hard to do, you know.
And it's funny you're talking about being 11 years old. Funny enough, I think I was probably 11 years old when I discovered that album. I remember going into Durham with my Christmas money and buying Shea Heart Attack. It was one of the first albums I ever bought, and it's still in my top five of all time. So not just by my favourite band, but my favourite album by my favourite band. Absolutely, Shea Heart Attack is that album.
Definitely. Obviously, when this album came out and it made this massive impression, for me, this was still a year and a half away from me hearing Thin Lizzy. Queen really were the first rock band that I ever heard, courtesy of my oldest brother. And up until that point, I'd been listening to Sweet, Hello and Mudd, you know, and they were like my favourite bands, you know. And then Queen just were this big grown-up band that came out. And I can remember having like the laminate sleeve and the inner sleeve with the lyrics on, thinking, this is how, you know, grown-ups buy their records, you know, the kids' albums all like knocked together and never get an inner sleeve and stuff, or laminated sleeves, you know. And I remember it being a big deal that it was like a grown-up album. Like you said, I mean, Queen 2, it literally is sort of on its shoulder for me because of March of the Black Queen and stuff like that. But I just think from Brighton Rock to The Lap of the Gods Revisited, you just daren't take the needle up. You know, you just want to play the whole thing time and time again so you know what's coming next. I mean, the way the tracks merged together, no one was doing that. Well, not in my world at that point. So to hear, like, Tenement Funster going to Flick of the Wrist and then that going into Lily of the Valley, I mean, it was like a big lasting impression on me. Queen are a one-off, you know.
Now, Shea Heart Attack comes relatively early in Queen's history, being released just over a year after their debut album Queen and not long after their follow-up Queen 2. For the uninitiated, where were the band at this point in their career, and what was the mood heading into Shea Heart Attack?
Well, from what I've sort of, as history goes on, and I've obviously learnt about sort of, you know, the whole thing. I mean, back in the day, they absolutely murdered Queen on Queen 2. The reviews were rubbish, you know, and yet now everyone reveres it as such a groundbreaking album. And yet at the time, they just said it was all faff, you know, it was all overproduced nonsense, you know. And I think with Shea Heart Attack, maybe they decided to sort of like cut it back and go a bit more for the rock approach. And obviously Brian May was very ill, so he was doing his stuff last knockings while the rest of the band were ploughing on. I mean, when you just take that into consideration and they turn up this album as good as Shea Heart Attack, I mean, God knows what the band were, you know, what sort of state of disarray they were in if Brian May was in hospital for half of it. But like you said, that middle patch of Queen 2, Shea Heart Attack, Night the Opera, Dirt the Race is untouchable. Absolutely untouchable.
Yeah. So to focus a little more on Queen's situation surrounding the album, the band were managed by Trident Productions at the time, who had them on a measly wage that saw them essentially living hand to mouth, despite having a strong following on tour and a top 10 single in Seven Seas of Rye. So we'd learn a lot more about that as they started work on A Night at the Opera. But was that kind of arrangement common for bands in the 70s, or did Queen just get a particularly raw deal on this one?
You know, bands were signing to labels on a wage, so they were sort of being put on the road and they were getting paid every week as professional musicians. So for them, that was like, you know, well, hey, give up the day job. You know, it's good at the time because you think, that's all right, we're in now, but you're tied into them for a long time. And of course, within 18 months, they were global and they were smashing records out left, right and centre, and they were tied to this deal that they just couldn't get out of until obviously they got the... Is it Jonathan Reed, I think it was, wasn't it, that came in and said, I'll sort your business end out, you go and make the best album you can make, which obviously was Night at the Opera. But, yeah, I mean, I can only assume that over that period of time, record deals were exceptionally tight and there to rip the bands off, which has been the same way through the 50s and the 60s. You know, bands were just employed to play songs, go and play them live, record, and... I don't know. I think at that time of the industry, maybe it was quite like a novice type thing. You know, it was still finding its feet. And it wasn't until later on when the big deals were reneged that obviously the band started to realise they could have more clout. You know, it's amazing to think of that when you look back. You know, I mean, I think Led Zeppelin were probably the first band that absolutely turned the game around, you know, and made their own record label and licensed their product so they retained as much of the control as possible, because they're making money hand over fist. So I think they paved the way for the big change.
So in spite of all of that, as we said earlier, Queen were gaining traction as a must-see live band. They're in the middle of a successful tour of America with Mott the Hoople, when, as you touched upon earlier, Brian was diagnosed with hepatitis and he had to fly home. Not only that, but when after he recovered from hepatitis, he was back in hospital with a stomach ulcer. So this meant, as we'd said, that the rest of Queen had to work on a lot of the album during his absence, and then they essentially had 2 weeks to complete it once he was out. That kind of timescale, as you were touching on earlier, that's like, it must be unheard of now.
It's ridiculous. I mean, if you said that to me, that's what would happen to me, I'd probably go and hang myself. You got 2 weeks, like, I couldn't even make a cup of tea into it. You know, bearing in mind, Brian, bless him, you know, he's legendary for his particularness about how he does stuff. You know, I mean, the stories and the interviews over the years are of, you know, humongous, you know, proportions about how he does his stuff. But then, you know, what price you pay for the genius that he is. You know, I mean, I know Mike Moran very well. He's a good friend of mine. And, you know, he's worked with Queen and Brian and Freddie. And, you know, he's told me stories. And it's just an honour to sit in his presence and listen to these things, you know. And it is absolutely hilarious, some of it. But this is the price of genius. You know, I mean, Cats in Space, we record as much analog as possible. We're very, very old school, and that's part of our appeal, maybe. But ultimately, we still have to go on to Pro Tools to, you know, to do that side of things. And when you can see stuff, you can chop and move things around at a rapid rate of knots. In the old days, you're just rewinding tape back to a cue, yeah, and then starting and dropping in, you know, the various things that were being re-recorded. You know, just that alone takes an eon compared to what it is nowadays. So I don't know. I've got no idea how Brian May would have done what he had to do and end up producing what they did. It's staggering, you know. I've actually heard, funnily enough, the backing master tracks to Stone Cold Crazy, and it's astonishing. You can actually hear the air in the room, and this little tiny deaky speaker that I think he was using to record through. It was almost like, you know, it was just like almost on fire. And the sound is just amazing. And if he did that when he wasn't very well, then, well, you know, the rest of us might as well give up. He's not from this planet. I'm sure none of them are, really.
And it's funny, I mean, he said back in 1974, I felt really bad at having let the group down at such an important place. But there was nothing to do about it. It was hepatitis, which you get sometimes when you're emotionally run down. And it's this idea that he I've read stuff before that he, like I say, he thought that the group would get rid of him while he was ill. And that idea that he would even contemplate, that's almost like hilarious, really.
I mean, you can imagine Queen trying to replace Brian May. I mean, it's that's the thing with Queen, the glue. You know, the four of them are glue. That I can't think of many other bands, maybe Zeppelin, the other band, that you just could not replace a member. You know, I can't think of too many that, I mean, Rush, obviously, because there's three of them, but yeah, I mean, to sort of think of Brian May, I mean, he was being poached by Sparks, funnily enough. They were saying to him, your band's going nowhere, why don't you join us? And they were trying to get him to join Sparks, apparently. So one of the stories goes, but now it beggars belief that Queen would have sort of, you know, not had him in the band. But it also amazes me to think that they might never have done Night at the Opera had they not got out of that Trident deal.
Yeah.
I mean, how about that? If that had happened and they'd split up in 75, it's amazing.
Absolutely. So whether it was due to necessity or just a need to grow musically, Sheer Heart Attack is arguably the best example in Queen's back catalogue that they can put their hand to any genre of music. So as we'll touch on when we go track by track, this album has songs that could fall into genres including power pop, speed metal, even vaudeville. Is this the sound of a band trying to find themselves, or is it more a case of them saying, look what we can do?
That's a good question, isn't it? Well, I suppose in a global answer, I can't imagine Queen wanting to be a complete vaudeville band. But I just think that, you know, when you've got like these artistic heads that are banging against each other, and they're all songwriters in their own right, which is, bearing in mind, this is the first album John Deacon wrote on as well. So now you've got four creative forces, all with their own stamp, all trying to make the Queen sound, if you like. And maybe they just thought, well, let's just do everything because we can. Yeah, I mean, I think that's very of the time where bands were doing these kind of knockbacks to obviously the 50s, because then it was only 20 years, not even 20 years old. So obviously the rock and roll thing was still very evident, you know, with all the sort of vaudeville and that kind of stuff. Bringing that into the pot, I think, was a little nod to the Beatles, possibly, and to be able to pull off a different kind of music, stick it next to a blistering rock track, and it still sounds cohesive as that band. Which has always been my remit. I've always wanted to be in a band that can do that too. And there's not many that can dare try it. And there's not many that probably want to do it, to be honest. But I've always been fascinated by how Queen in particular can do Leroy Brown, Stone Cold Crazy, within the space of 5 minutes. And everyone goes, yeah, but it's Queen.
So there are two tracks we know of that didn't make the album, but would make future albums. Queen's rendition of the national anthem, God Save the Queen, which ended up on the end of A Night at the Opera, and at the end of every Queen concert thereafter. And the song itself, Sheer Heart Attack, which found a home on News of the World. Roger probably allegedly didn't get that song finished in time. But that's, again, it's a great example of just how fruitful these Sheer Heart Attack sessions were under an immense amount of pressure.
Yes, definitely. I mean, Sheer Heart Attack, the track, which, I mean, that came out in 77. So you think he would have recorded it somewhere in 77. Amazing to think that he kept that on the shelf for, what, 2.5, 3 years, maybe? Unbelievable. And how did it sound in 74? Because if it sounded like it sounded in 77, Roger Taylor invented punk. Maybe he sped it up, I don't know. But, yeah, I find it quite weird that that was actually written for Sheer Heart Attack, because, wow.
So the first single was Killer Queen. It was released in October 1974, and the album followed a few weeks later. The band became a success overnight, with Killer Queen reaching number two, as did the album. What made Queen click with the UK music audience at that point that perhaps they'd been missing previously?
I think Seven Seas of Rye was, again, when it came out the same time as Sparks. This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us, if I remember rightly. Both came out in sort of mid-74. And I think it was that kind of era when glam rock was, you know, sort of peaking, if you like. And I think maybe this was like the natural progression, that it was just lining up nicely that whatever Queen was going to follow Seven Seas of Rye with was going to be a hit, you know. And Killer Queen, like I said, you know, for a song that's only 3 minutes long, to have that amount of musicality, you know, the lyric as well was very off the wall for its time, and it wasn't all wham bam shang-a-lang like most of the songs were at that time. He was coming out with this outrageous sort of lyric, and it just seemed to make everybody, you know, step and take notice. And of course, and then they go and do Top of the Pops, and there's this goofy guy with black hair and a big fur coat on, you know, out camping out in John. And I just think people just took to it as a, you know, a totally new thing.
So now seems a good time as any just to go track by track and go through each one and just kind of see what makes this album so great. So if we start with Brighton Rock. Brighton Rock was written by Brian May and had working titles of Bognor Ballad, Southend Sea Scout, and my personal favourite, Happy Little Fuck. So Queen have had some strong album openers over the years. Do you think that this is the best song to open a Queen album?
Oh, see, now this is where you've got me. I knew you were going to say that. For me, the ultimate opening of any album that's ever been pressed is still, for me, Procession into Father to Son. That's still, for me, the greatest opening of any album ever. But for pure outrageousness, Brighton Rock, to come out the traps as it does, and the way the vocal comes in, and that the speed, you know, the BPM of the track is really fast, it's like, wow. I mean, it's the only thing that could have possibly have topped Procession and Father to Son, which obviously is a lot slower, but musically wise, I still prefer Father to Son. But Brighton Rock as a standalone rock track with that guitar solo is amazing, and it's even to this day listening to that copycat solo that he does. Yeah, I would say it's second place best album opener ever. Yes,
it's really interesting that you should say that, because when I think about Procession and Father to Son, I've been listening, obviously, to Too Many Gods, which is your first album with Cats in Space. And I think that that kind of, like, arrival into the title track is very like Procession, Father to Son. It's kind of got this kind of really climactic intro straight into the album. So it is really interesting that you'd say that.
Yeah, I mean, I was almost going to do for the new album a guitar intro and take it into, like, a two-minute instrumental, but I'm very much into that. You've got to set your album up. And I've said this numerous times in interviews, that I don't like albums as just 10 tracks that you can just shuffle about and they all work in any order. I like to be taken on a 40-minute journey from track one to the end, like a little mini opera or mini theatre production, where you go along, the curtain comes up, they build you in, they take you on a journey, then they do you the big ending. And Queen are the masters at doing that. Their album's running in this lovely flow, and you just cannot split it and change it and swap it around. You wouldn't want to, you know. And Cats is absolutely follows that remit, and that's something that I'm very passionate about, because I like to be taken on the 40-minute journey, so it's got some purpose. And Brighton Rock, I mean, it just sets the album up, you know, astonishingly well.
So we've started to touch on the solo already. It was lifted, or somewhat lifted, from a song called Blag by Smile, which was Brian May and Roger Taylor's previous band. Have you heard Blag, and can you hear kind of the roots of Brighton Rock in there?
Yeah, I have heard. I've heard a bootleg of Blag from something, I can't think where it was now, and there was that, and there was another couple of tracks on there as well, which escaped me. And I remember there was a song called Hangman as well around at that time. To be honest, I think the Brian solo in Brighton Rock that he had sort of fairly standard for quite a few years, and obviously built on it more for live, but it's such a lovely composition. Yes, again, so well thought out, and how he pieced it all together. I mean, everyone takes it for granted now when you listen to it, oh yeah, brilliant, but he actually analysed that, how he came from nothing and he made that solo. And to then stick it on the first track on an album, I mean, you've not even got the album going, and it's gone to a you know, this guitar work with a little bit of hi-hats going on. It's just amazing. So it's still, for me, probably one of the greatest Brian May moments, without a doubt.
I mean, Ultimate Classic Rock highlight Brian's health wars as the root of the sound of Brighton Rock. And they said, in that environment, it's easy to see how Brighton Rock, with its furious outburst of blues metal guitar set amid Mercury's story of star-crossed love, came to be. May sounds pent up, simply bursting with ideas throughout the album. That's nowhere more true than on this track. Is there a degree of kind of environmental factors when you're recording an album? So kind of any issues that happen in the moment, can they kind of bleed into the music in a positive or negative way?
I think so. Definitely when you're in the writing stage, without a doubt. I mean, myself and Mick Wilson, when we get together, we always talk about stuff of the day, and we have these fantastic conversations. We really should tape some of them, because we do get involved in some really good discussions, but all good light-hearted stuff. You definitely go down these little paths when you're writing, because it is an intense thing, and you're trying to make something that is going to, you're laying yourself on the line to be, you know, ridiculed, to be slagged off, or to be adored. You know, you don't know what that thing is going to become, but you put it out there for people to decide, and it's a very emotional process. And that emotion, if you can channel it in the right way, it can definitely influence how a song, you know, takes on its own set of legs, if you like. You know, and I'm a firm believer that you should let a song go its own route once you've sort of, you know, rolled the dice with it, you know. So definitely.
So our next track is Killer Queen. We've touched on Killer Queen quite a lot already. It's our first single from the album, part of a double A-side with Flick of the Wrist, which we're going to be talking about in a little bit. Written by Freddie, it reached number 2 in the UK, as we said, and made Queen a household name overnight. What are your thoughts on Killer Queen, and is it a good example of that classic sound that was developing with this album?
Perfect Queen. If someone said to me, give me one Queen track that is Queen, and I think Killer Queen would probably, or definitely top We Are the Champions, you know, because I just think Killer Queen has just got all that daring side that they were still really investigating. You know, as I said, you know, it's just an astonishing thing. And also, when you look at the mapping of Killer Queen, you know, the arrangement, it doesn't follow the path of what pop songs are doing, which are, you know, verse, bridge, chorus, breakdown out, you know, or maybe a little solo out. You know, Queen were putting in these cheeky little bits and going out on, you know, weird end, like the ending of Killer Queen. What a weird ending. It goes out on a repeat with a little hook. You know, it's, you just wouldn't do that these days. So it's pretty untouchable for me. You know, it's the jewel in the crown, pretty much, as far as singles go. Ironically held off of number one by David Essex. David Essex was humongous at that time, and he was outselling everybody. So one for the trivia there.
Completely unrelated, but it's just reminded me of something from kind of my sort of teenage years. There was a chart one week where it seemed like loads of the rock songs were going to kind of top the chart. We're talking about 99, 2000. And I remember listening with my friend, who was really excited because he was so sure that Teenage Dirtbag by Wheatus was going to be number one. He was sitting there like listening to the top 40 in a way that we just don't do anymore. Number 3 was Papa Roach, Last Resort. Number 2 was Wheatus, Teenage Dirtbag. And number 1 was Atomic Kitten, Hole Again. And he was so angry that he phoned the radio station and ranted at them for 10 minutes. But it just made me think there, when you think about kind of what songs kind of get kept off number one by others, it was just something I'd been thinking about.
Well, the big one for me was The Darkness with Christmas Time. That was an absolute rip-off. That was, they were duped so massively there. That, I mean, that was number one. That blimmin' song that, I don't even know what his name is, Mad World, that horrendous, horrible, morose song that I detest. But apparently they were allowing, downloads or something for the first time, and no one knew how to control it. So they were bunging those in the mix with actual physical sales, and that's how it got to number one. But The Darkness, I mean, it was so obvious. And I can actually remember, and it's the last time I've done it, I've never done it since, but I actually went on to CFAX on the Sunday to check the British chart and who was going to be number one that week. I think it was for Christmas, wasn't it? And I couldn't believe it when he done it, but hey ho.
So to jump back to Killer Queen, Freddie said to NME at the time, people are used to hard rock, energy music from Queen. Yet with this single, you almost expect Noel Coward to sing it. It's one of those bowler hat, black suspender belt numbers. It's about a high class call girl. I'm trying to say that classy people can be whores as well.
Yes. Very Freddie, that is, isn't it? Yes.
It is.
Very Freddie.
It is.
Yeah, it's got that kind of bowler hat, sort of like, you know, kicking one leg out in front of the, like, Liza Minnelli sort of thing. Yeah, definitely. But again, from when I was 11 years old, it just sounded like it was coming from outer space. It just didn't sound like... I think I heard a lot of the sweet in there, to be honest. I mean, obviously, with the massive vocals. So it was, I had that kind of comfortable, you know, your favourite jumper, you know, when you put it on, you feel comfortable because the harmonies I was associating with all the sweet songs. But it was just a different band doing it, and one played a piano, you know. But I could understand why he said all that. They were just already saying to people, we're more than a rock band, you know. And I think they must have been a bit aggrieved as being compared to a third-rate Led Zeppelin, and Yes, which, for love nor money, I don't understand. You know, I don't hear Yes in hardly anything that Queen did at all. But, you know, such is the music press, maybe. At that time, I should say. Not now, of course. They're wonderful now.
But it's interesting you should talk about kind of if there was one song that you would pick that kind of encapsulate Queen, it's Killer Queen. Because for me, it's kind of, when I think of Freddie, obviously a lot of people would immediately go to Bohemian Rhapsody. For me, it's Killer Queen that instantly jumps to mind when I think of him. Paul Fowles wrote in his book, A Concise History of Rock Music, that Sheer Heart Attack saw the band become increasingly focused on the emerging cult figure of Mercury and his iconic and his unique brand of rock theatre. Is this kind of the moment that the legend of Freddie Mercury is born, so to speak?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I remember that minute on Top of the Pops when he's in the fur coat and he does the thing with the mic stand, and there's old Deaky there with his Fender Precision and Brian with his funny-looking guitar, which I didn't know what make it was at that time, and Roger sort of tickling this drum kit. I can just see it. Even now, I can see the four of them there, and I just thought, these aren't from this planet. They're just, you know, geniuses from another place, you know, and... Yeah, it was just such an iconic moment. I mean, Bo Rap is... You can't really put Bohemian Rhapsody into any conversation. It stands alone in the world as its own thing, its own entity, because it's never been done again. It's never been done before, never been done since. And it's unfair to almost bring it into the pot because it was such a standalone moment. But Killer Queen, for me, really did surmise definitely Queen at that point. Because it was a chart hit, so it proved that they could have pop hits of this quality and intelligence, and it had all the trademarks of the Brian May solo, the, you know, the Deaky bass lines, and the Roger Taylor's sort of great snare work, and obviously all Freddie's vocals and stuff. It just had everything, you know.
Greg Hart there, chatting with me about Queen's phenomenal album, Sheer Heart Attack, and we're going to get back to Greg in just a little bit. Coming up, why should you avoid putting In the Lap of the Gods on a shuffled playlist? And was Stone Cold Crazy the start of thrash metal? All that and more, right after this.
They'd never done anything like this album before, ever. There was such a mix of stuff on it.
Would you like to get involved with the discussion on My Classic Album? Or maybe you'd like to be a guest on a future episode?
I don't think there's any other album that is so poignant and so human in its lyrics.
Like us on Facebook by searching for My Classic Album with Mike Norris. Alternatively, you could follow us on Instagram at My Classic Album Podcast, or even tweet us over at MCA_podcast.
This music is inside of me, and I couldn't not be influenced by it if I tried.
But at the time, it blew my mind, and it blew millions of people's mind, and that's why it's my classic record.
Make sure you never miss an episode and keep up to date with all the latest news at www.myclassicalbum.co.uk.
Why is whatever people say I am, that's what I'm not, your classic album? And why should people check it out?
It was amazing, that's why.
So we'll move on to Tenement Funster. So the next three tracks, for those who don't know, make up a medley of sorts on the album. And they all kind of flow into each other, like you were alluding to before. But they're all great songs in their own right. Tenement Funster is up first, as I said, and it's been written and sung by Roger Taylor. So casual fans of Queen might be surprised to hear that Freddie often passed vocals over to Roger and Brian on their own songs throughout the band's career, particularly early on. Are you a fan of Roger's voice, which is perhaps a more typical rock vocal than Freddie's?
Roger Taylor's just a legend, full stop. He's just
monster.
He's a monster. He's along with Mick Tucker, he's my favourite drummer. I just love everything he's ever done on the drum kit, period. I just think he's the most intelligent and, if it's possible, a melodic drummer, he's that. And then he's got this blooming voice that is just stunning. In any other band, he'd be the lead singer. You know, yeah, in any other band, with those blonde, you know, the blonde hair and the good looks and his sort of rock star persona, he would be, you know, he'd be a killer front man, you know. So for him to settle behind the drums and be happy to let Freddie do the bit, again, shows the depth and the sheer quality of what the band is. But, yeah, I can just remember when he first did those opening lines in My New Purple Shoes. I mean, it's like, wow, who's this, you know? And that guitar picked right next to the bridge, so that twangy treble where the string literally goes over the bridge of the guitars. And I remember thinking, oh, I could learn to play that because that's an A minor, you know, an E minor, whatever the chord was. And it was one of the first things that I learned to play when I could play those chords, that we all went to school and went, I can play the opening of Tenement Funster. And instant God, you know what I mean? You're, you know, you're revered throughout school as being the kid that can play a Queen song. Couldn't play half of the rest of it, you know, just that opening little segment, and that where it goes up to the D chord. That's, again, I'm going a bit technical here, but the he plays three D chords in a row, like this cascading thing that you wouldn't always do that. It just doesn't necessarily make sense, but it's a beautiful, weird melody that he gets, just amazing, almost like it's coming from a bloke that probably doesn't know the rudiments of guitar that well at that point. But he recognises those chords make a good racket and he can play them, you know. And it's, I might be wrong there, he might have been, you know, well up on his chords, but the whole progression of that guitar piece and the way it goes into that guitar solo, wow. Just, you'd never go to that key change. That key change to the solo is just not what people did as songwriters. It's totally off-piste, as I say, and that's the genius. It's taking those leaps where you go to that key there, you can't do that, it sounds horrendous. No, watch, because I'll do this and it'll make it sound brilliant. And sure enough, in comes that sort of backwardy Brian May guitar solo, and it's just, oh, mega. Even to this day, that opening piece gives me sort of tingles when I hear that guitar. It's brilliant.
I mean, I absolutely love Roger's contributions to any Queen album, but particularly the early ones. I mean, for me personally, honourable mentions go to Drowse from A Day at the Races. But for me, Tenement Funster is my favourite Queen song with Roger on lead vocals. Where does it rank for you amongst Roger's contributions?
I would say, am I allowed to have a tie at the top?
Yeah, yeah.
Tenement Funster and I'm In Love With My Car without doubt. Drowse would definitely be probably after that. I'm going to have to flick through my albums here. I'll tell you one, what's the other one? The one I really like is, I think he was the main composer of that song, Small, the track Small, which is off of the Cosmos Rocks.
Yeah, yeah. There's a version floating around, a solo version of that. I think it might be on Fun on Earth, possibly.
What a song. Oh, yeah. That, for a later day song, I mean, I'm not going to talk about Paul Rogers, so might as well forget about that because I don't like him. But that album, that track was just off the record. And obviously, I think Roger, he did Made in Heaven as well, didn't he? I think that was one of his, probably. And obviously, Loser in the End would probably have to be top five as well, because it's obviously off of Queen too.
So we'll move on to Flick of the Wrist. As I said, it's the other side of the Killer Queen double A-side. Written and sung by Freddie. Its viciousness is almost kind of a precursor to Death on Two Legs that would come out of the opera.
Very much so. Very much so. Yeah. And for me, best track on the album.
Really?
Yep. Yep. Yeah. As you've hit the two tracks there, Flick of the Wrist and Death on Two Legs, my favourite tracks on both those albums. You know, it's like a real high drama. And then all of a sudden, that Don't Look Back line kicks in and it's, oh, it takes it into a different level, you know, and it's just, it just hits you so hard, that track. It's, again, it's like going to the theatre and you get that kind of the wicked part of the show, you know, which comes in. And I think it might not have had the same impact had that had stood alone without having Lily of the Valley and Tenement Funster go on either side of it. But it's just got that, and it's got that whiplash noise that comes in as well, which I've always tried to, I'm still trying to work out how they did that because I want to use that somewhere because I think it's really good. A magnificent magnificent 3 minutes.
And I think what people tend to forget, as we've said, is that it wasn't the B-side to Killer Queen, it was the double A-side, but obviously Killer Queen got kind of all the airplay and the plaudits.
They were never going to play that. They were never going to play that as the A-side. I don't know where that came from. I think that might be them taking the piss, to be honest, because how is Radio 1 going to play a song called Flick of the Wrist in 1974 when they'd already banned Turn It Down by The Sweet because they said, for God's sake, turn it down? I mean, they ain't going to play Flick of the Wrist, are they, really? And obviously, I don't think I ever heard that on the radio. I can't ever remember hearing it, because Killer Queen was, you know, just so strong, wasn't it, really?
I mean, Freddie was never hugely open about talking about the meanings behind his songs, which we'll talk a little bit about in a minute. But it's heavily alluded that Death on Two Legs from Night at the Opera was about their manager, Northern Sheffield. So, As She a Heart Attack was recorded not long before Night at the Opera, is there a possibility that kind of that relationship they had with Sheffield's kind of bleeding into this song a little bit and they're exploring similar themes?
I think so. I mean, again, you know, none of us know, do we? But I would hazard a very good guess that by the time they were doing Flick of the Wrist, they were already thinking, we need to get rid of these people that are managing us, and they're sort of ripping us off. And obviously, Death on Two Legs was the ultimate, right, now they've gone, I can really say what I wanted to say, where this is a little bit sort of cloaked in sort of double entendre or whatever. Whereas had there been Justin Hawkins, of course, years later, he just wrote a song called The Wanker. So, you know, part of my language, radio listeners, but, you know, he just comes straight out and said it. So maybe this was them just trying to disguise what they were really trying to say a bit. But, yeah, I think it was pretty obvious. Of course, when you're 11-year-old kids and you're reading the lyrics, I ain't got a clue what they mean. It just sounds like some vicious bloke that wants to kill someone, you know. You don't look into it as an 11-year-old, you know. It's only looking back when you hear the history of the band that you can start piecing little bits together and, you know, making your own sort of minds up as to what they were doing.
So after the intensity of a song like Flick of the Wrist, Lily of the Valley is a really interesting one for me. I've always felt that the song was heavily rooted in fantasy, much like a lot of other songs around that time period for Queen. But more recently, I've read stuff that makes me feel a bit differently. Before I kind of get into that, what are your thoughts on Lily of the Valley at this point in the album?
You know, I was sort of very heavily into Narnia when I was a kid. I loved the whole concept of Narnia and Lion, Witch and the Wardrobe. And I just sort of, as a kid, I sort of made my own little mind up that maybe these are like little fantasy C.S. Lewis sort of snapshots, you know. And, you know, because I didn't know the background or knew what he was probably doing. And so I just took them as little fantasy songs, really, that to me sounded a bit like they could have been in Narnia, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, and I guess that's it. I mean, I always kind of felt the same about them. And, you know, we're talking about songs, you know, Fairyfellas, Masterstroke, March of the Black Queen, Seven Seas of Rye. Lily of the Valley falls into this category specifically with the lyric, "Messenger from Seven Seas has flown to tell the King of Rye he's lost his throne." So people have mentioned in the past that Rye could potentially have been this made-up world by Freddie and his sister Kashmira when they were children. You know, I guess from what you're saying, you saw the link between these kind of Rye songs and how they're all connected on the, particularly on the first three albums.
Yeah, I think, again, there was like, it's sort of, they're following a thread, aren't they? I mean, the bands of the time, you know, a lot of their songs, they were sort of almost sort of, not milking the situation, but they were writing similar stuff to keep that thread going. So people, you know, knew there's this continuation going on between the albums, you know, like the Chinny Chapman stuff. All the songs had the same words and the same titles, very close. You know, they only moved a smidgen each time they released a single, so kids felt very familiar with it all. And maybe this was like Freddie having this continuation. Maybe his whole plan was that he wanted to say stuff that was spread out over those albums rather than trying to do it all on one. I don't know. Maybe just like referring back to it just because it's all part of, like you said, this sort of thing that was in his head from when he was a kid as well. I don't know, but it's very easy to tap back into stuff. I mean, I do it myself, you know, where I like to sort of like think, oh, that was a really good idea in that song, maybe we could reference and tip your hat to it, so people have that, oh yeah, I remember that from that last album, and it sort of bolts things together in a nice package. You know, again, it all comes down to this packaging a band's sort of sound together. So maybe not, I don't know. But it's a nice thing that you can relate back to other stuff on other albums of Queen at that time. I like all that kind of stuff.
So, as said more recently, I've read stuff that suggests that Lily of the Valley was, in fact, a very cloaked reference to Freddie coming to terms with his sexuality. And it was an interview with Brian May with Mojo magazine that kind of brought this to my attention. He'd said, "Freddie's stuff was so heavily cloaked lyrically. Lily of the Valley was utterly heartfelt. It's about looking at his girlfriend and realizing that his body needed to be somewhere else. It's a great piece of art, but it's the last song that would ever be a hit.
Yes. Yeah, that surmises it perfectly, really. Then in 1974, when you're 10, 11 years old, you don't understand all that kind of stuff. You know, you're certainly not going to know. But obviously, 40 years later, we've got all this information that's been spoken about over the years. So obviously, it's a lot easier to dissect. But where I was in 1974, I just considered it as a song that was a piece of mythical magic that came from a different land, maybe. You know, I don't know. But yeah, I mean, I think that what you just said there probably surmises the situation perfectly, really.
So before we move on to the next song, as we'd said, the previous three were kind of like a medley on Sheer Heart Attack, blending one into the other. And Dream Theater even covered all three of these songs together on one track on their album Black Clouds and Silver Linings in 2009. Do you ever listen to these songs separately, or is it a case of kind of Tenement Funster, Flick of the Wrist and Lily of the Valley? Are they kind of forever to be played together in sequence?
I must admit, putting on any track off this album individually is virtually nil. Because if I put Sheer Heart Attack on, I listen to Sheer Heart Attack in its entirety, then I turn it off and think, that was lovely. But, I mean, yes, I've got a Spotify account, and yes, I've got a Queen jukebox in there, but I never put it on shuffle, hardly ever. So I don't like listening to things out of context. I don't like it. I mean, it's just not what I do, really. I mean, and plus, I play vinyl 99% of the time as well, so once the needle's on, it's on. You know, I very, very, very rarely take the needle up unless the phone goes or, you know, the cat's been sick or something. So it's, Flick of the Wrist into Lily Valley, you know, murder he that interrupts that piano segue. You just don't do that. You just don't take Freddie's fingers off the piano. You just don't do this. It's outrageous behaviour. I couldn't do it. I'd feel if I did it here, 100 people would run up my stairs going, aha, we've caught you, you do that, you know. So, so no, you don't touch Freddie's fingers when you're on the piano. Oh, no, dear.
No. So we'll move on to Now I'm Here, which was written by Brian May, the second single off the album in the UK, and was written by Brian while he was convalescing in hospital. Was Now I'm Here the best choice for a follow-up single for Killer Queen, or are there other tracks on the album that you, personally, if you were in the band at that time, you would have gone for instead?
Well, that's a good question, because funnily enough, I don't hear that many singles on this album, probably why I like it so much. I don't hear an immediate Killer Queen. Again, Killer Queen stood alone as such an amazing single. And I don't know, possibly In the Lap of the Gods Revisited, possibly, maybe, you know, a possible follow-up single. I don't know. I really don't think there's a cast iron second single on this album. I really don't. And Now I'm Here, I wouldn't put that as a single, because it's quite a wacky piece of music. It's very heavy. I mean, it hasn't really got a chorus as such. It goes round a refrain and, you know, a verse and et cetera, but it doesn't have that kind of chorus as such. So I was always surprised when that came out as the follow-up single, thinking, it wasn't as good as Killer Queen, dare I say. I mean, the guitar riff is one of the greatest riffs ever, you know. I mean, it's still to this day, it's a hell of a riff to try and learn. And it's got that amazing guitar sound on the intro, but I certainly wouldn't say that's a one of the big singles, in my opinion, anyway.
So the song is about the band's time touring the US before Brian was struck down with hepatitis, and it particularly highlights the jarring experience of touring in the US one minute and then being brought back down to earth, coming home the next. Is that kind of a common experience in the early days of a band, where you feel kind of the highs of the rock and roll lifestyle before you head back home to normality?
Yeah, I mean, I think when they're drawing on what can they write about, obviously the first thing you can write about is when you're on the road, because it's a real thing that happens and you can describe it how it happens to you, I guess. So, you know, rather than making up stories that, you know, you don't exist or you don't really know what you're talking about, bands obviously know about road travel, road life, playing with other bands, crowds, etc. So, yeah, I would have thought that's a fairly obvious one to do. And obviously the Motley Hoople tour absolutely put them on the map, you know, so it was obviously a big deal at the time. And obviously Brian, being the way that he is, you know, made it a good sort of little snapshot of, you know, of writing about something that happened at that time. So in that respect, the lyric is fabulous. You know, it's a great period of, like, sort of the Queen's history, where everyone relates to that tour when they supported Mott the Hoople. They were watching one of the, you know, a band that's going to become one of the biggest bands ever. Everyone knew it at the time. You know, I didn't because I was too young. Queen supporting Mott the Hoople was the turning point that put them into, you know, headline status.
So we've talked a bit about Mott the Hoople. Now I'm Here has references to the band, including the lyric "Down in the City, just Hoople and me." Ian Hunter said it was nice, but there was no money attached to it. That friendship endured as Ian Hunter joined the surviving members of Queen on stage during the Freddie Mercury tribute concert to sing "All the Young Dudes." Are you a fan of Mott the Hoople, and do you think that they kind of influenced Queen? Like, how strongly do you think that influences in their music?
I used to love Mott the Hoople, that early stuff. You know, when I, again, going back to when it was all singles and stuff before I got into album. You know, when they did like "All the Young Dudes," "Honolulu Boogie," "Roll Away the Stone" is just one of the greatest singles ever. You know, just incredible, and I love that. You know, that whacked piano. I really, really love all that sort of crazy stuff. And I never really got into them as a, in a big way, because I was so heavily into like Queen and Sweet and Slade and Mudd at that time. You know, I didn't really allow Mott the Hoople too much space, really. And again, a lot of my stuff came from my eldest brother, and he was never really a Mott the Hoople fan either. So I didn't get to listen to his music come out of his bedroom, you know, so I didn't get influenced by it too much. But much later, I got into some of their albums, and again, they were very, very theatrical and playing amazing stuff, you know, and, you know, great players and everything. So I think they would have been a big influence on Queen for that period of time when they were on the road with them, definitely, because Mott the Hoople were massive.
So we'll move on to In the Lap of the Gods. Now, I remember hearing this song for the first time, as you say, listening to the album in sequence, and just being totally scared shitless. And you talk about kind of having Queen on shuffle. I wouldn't recommend having this song in any kind of Queen shuffle playlist. And then I was shocked to learn that vocal is in fact Roger Taylor, who's just turned this kind of really gravelly, awesome Tenement Funster earlier on. Surely it's the most memorable start to any Queen song.
Oh, it's mental. I mean, again, those chords that roll underneath that, the sort of the vocal thing and the timing. I mean, it is. I wish I could think of something that is that dramatic that I could write, because I listen to that and think, who thought of that? I mean, it is like a horror film. It's also like a West End thing. It's operatic. It's whether it's them trying to do this cod opera thing that became Bo Rap, I don't know. But like you said, it's got this weird stuff going on, and then the vocal goes through this. It sounds like a phaser, but it almost makes it sound like it's underwater. And I want to know how they did that, because that, again, it's got this octave thing going on that was really scary. And it's, but then when the drums kick in and Roger's high vocal comes in, it's just amazing. As you said, it scares you shitless, and it's just wacky. And I didn't like it for a long time. I thought it was the poor track on the album. But as time went on, you know, it became one of my favourites. I just love it. Absolutely love it.
And it's funny you should say that, because, I mean, it was always the track that I was kind of a bit about when I was younger. It is maybe a lot closer in tone to kind of the more fantasy-related stuff they were doing on previous albums. Do you think that kind of because of, obviously, the wacky intro and this kind of altered vocal of Freddie, it would be the most testing song for a casual Queen fan if they're trying to get into this album?
I think so, yeah. I mean, because if you're going to just say, oh, what a Queen like, that's not one of the songs that you would that you'd want to play that then, really. You know, it's like, it's a little bit left of field in the Queen catalogue, isn't it? But explain how good they were at doing these vocals. It's just a bonkers song, isn't it, really?
So we'll move on to Stone Cold Crazy. It's the first song in Queen's catalogue with a writing credit for all four members of the band. Easily one of the heaviest songs in their history, let alone the album. A live favourite. And as we'll get on to, there's far more to the song than there appears on first listen. Do you think that Stone Cold Crazy was potentially, we're talking about kind of a song that could have been a second single? Could Stone Cold Crazy have been that single?
Could have been. Actually, yes. I mean, accessible-wise, although it's ridiculously fast and phenomenal hook line in there, so that could have dragged people onto the radio, I reckon. But, it had that kind of wacky hook, but... Yeah, it could have been a single, I guess. Yeah, no reason why it couldn't have been, but it is a phenomenal hard rock song, you know, and it's got that kind of no music in the verse, where it's just like a ticking of the hi-hat, you know, and just this really quick vocal, then, you know, machine gun fire drum fill, and then everybody back in again. It's just, you know, another bonkers song that just tight, so tight as well when you listen to the backing track. It is so tight. And again, you've got that key change thing going on, and, you know, it doesn't end with a hook. It ends with half of a verse and just ends, you know. Like they've said it all in 2 minutes and, you know, put the kettle on. It's brilliant. Just brilliant. I must be honest, I don't like hearing people cover it, because it's like the old, oh, we can cover that, blah, blah, blah. Metallica did it, and I thought they just, please don't ever do that again.
That's really interesting. I was going to get onto Metallica's cover, actually. Q magazine called Stone Cold Crazy thrash metal before the term was invented. And due to its speed and heavy distortion, it's been called a precursor to speed metal. And as you've said, Metallica cite the song as a huge influence and they covered it. Do you agree with the perception that Stone Cold Crazy is an essential piece of the puzzle in the development of heavy metal?
No, not really.
No?
I don't really know, because at the end of the day, Black Sabbath, Deep Purple were way ahead of it. I mean, Speed King, you know, this is 74, don't forget, but yeah, Deep Purple on 1972, 1973 were doing fast stuff. Sabbath were all over the kip doing various bits and bobs. I think Stone Cold Crazy is far too musical to be put into that horrendous dirge. You know, it's Metallica and me don't get on. I just don't buy it. I don't understand it. And everyone, each to their own, good luck to everybody. But no, Metallica do Stone Cold Crazy at Wembley was just, yeah, well, 3 minutes I'll never get back. Strong view coming out there, but no, I don't like, oh, they invented thrash metal. No, they didn't. I don't think so. They're too good for that. Thrash metal isn't about having a Freddie Mercury style vocal doing what it does. You know, so it's only because it's fast that they think, oh, it's thrash metal because it's fast. Well, Machine Head's fast. You know, there's other bands. I mean, Sweet did Set Me Free. I mean, which was obviously very heavily Deep Purple influenced. You know, and Set Me Free is faster than Stone Cold Crazy as well. And it came out the same year. So, no, I don't buy into the thrash metal. How dare they even say the Queen are.
So we'll move on to Dear Friends. A very short interlude after the frenzy that Stone Cold Crazy. Written by Brian, sung by Freddie. It showcases the beautiful harmonies of Queen. What are your thoughts on Dear Friends? And could it have been more than the short interlude that it is?
Yes. I was hoping when I heard it that it was going to kick into like a big power ballad. But then again, that's, again, the genius, isn't it? It's when you put the brakes on, and you go, oh, God, why do they do that? We'll go listen to it again, you know. There's a lot to be said for just, you know, putting the brake on and not over-labelling the point. And if he said all he wanted to say, then so be it. I mean, you could argue that maybe it was an unfinished song that could have been a longer song, but again, that's the glory of, you know, where Queen and, you know, the like were at that time. They could do this kind of thing and just make these lovely little snapshot songs that just said enough. When you can write a concise little piece of music that maybe 8 lines or 4 lines or whatever, and you can say all you wanted to say in that tiny little snapshot, it's sometimes far more rewarding than writing a fantastic 4-minute song or a 3-minute song. You know, it's all about encompassing that little idea. But when it's only just over a minute long, it's brilliant. And again, it leads into the next track perfectly well.
It does, yeah. And I mean, talking about kind of cover versions of tracks off this album, Def Leppard actually covered this one on a special edition of their covers album, Yeah, with bassist Rick Savage singing lead vocals, albeit with more of a full arrangement. Have you heard that rendition? And if you have, what did you think of it?
I've not heard that, no. Right, no, I didn't. I've heard a song they did called something, is it Masters of the Universe or something, that is totally like Queen, and I absolutely took my hat off to them because it was a fantastic, fantastic song. Probably, for me, the best Def Leppard song ever. But, you know, Joe and Rick are huge Queen fans, as they've said many, many times over the years. And, you know, I've got a lot of time for Def Leppard. I think they're superb. And they're still fans of music, and they're not frightened of saying it. So old Rick Savage has always, you know, said about his influences all the time. So it doesn't surprise me, and I'd like to hear that. I must check it out, actually.
So we'll move on to Misfire. So This song's kind of special in the Queen back catalogue, as it's the first song solely credited to bass player John Deacon. In a band full of larger-than-life personalities, such as Freddie and Brian and Roger, I feel like John, and you said this at the beginning, is kind of like the hidden gem in Queen. Where does John rank for you amongst kind of the great bass players of all time?
Number one. End of story.
Number one.
End of story. Doesn't even need to be discussed. And anyone that says otherwise is a fool. He's an astonishing bass player, and for musicality to fit what he does amongst all that mentalness that goes on with a Queen song, and yet you hear Deke's bass. And okay, as years went on, and he became the most successful songwriter in the band, which, you know, was quite a surprise, but he did in the 80s. He was the big hitter. He was the go-to man to write the big hits, which was an astonishing thing to think of after May and Mercury for the 70s. But you should make a point of listening to every Queen album and just hone in on the bass guitar and listen to what he does on every song. And it's ridiculous. So when you've got that full spec Brian May guitars, the bass has to pocket somewhere where it won't get lost on the bottom end of the piano or the top end of the guitars. So he's playing a lot of the Queen bass lines. When you hone into it, they're not down the bottom. They're not original bass lines, but they're all down on your low Fs and Gs and As and stuff. He's playing these counter melodies at the top and running down, and it's, again, it makes that Queen sound. Listen to Killer Queen. You know, it's a classic example. One that we'll come on to shortly, of course. And the Millionaire Waltz off of Doubt Erases. So he's the jewel in the pack for me, as far as, I think he does get the recognition, and I'm glad he did with the hit singles, but I don't think people really dig into those early Queen albums and listen to his bass enough. It's astonishing what he does on some of those songs. And so musical as well, so right for the part of the song, you know. I mean, it's just, nothing is faff with Queen, you know. It's everything that's got a purpose. On the early albums, there's nothing is wasted. It's all lovely stuff, you know.
I read recently that Freddie nicknamed him the ostrich because he was so quiet until he produced the perfect egg. Some of those eggs include You're My Best Friend, I Want to Break Free, Another One Bites the Dust. Obviously, where does Misfire rank amongst John's selection of more of his more established hits? Where kind of would you put Misfire?
Again, it's only a short song that goes through about a million key changes. I wouldn't rank it as a jewel in the crown of his, but it was a very good marker to put down as your sort of first contribution. I mean, for me, You're My Best Friend is in a different world from the rest of his stuff. You know, it's one of my favourite songs. So obviously that's going to be number one. Spread Your Wings, I mean, check that out. How good is that? You know,
yeah.
Who Needs You off of the same album is a stunning song. Again, very, very overlooked, that song. And it's a brilliant song, Who Needs You. It's just a fun pop song. And I do believe he wrote Backchat off of Hot Space, which I absolutely love. And Backchat is probably top three John Deacon songs for me. I'm not a fan of I Want to Break Free, if I'm honest. I'm not a fan of that era, to be honest. I've found it a little bit tough going. And, of course, probably next to You're My Best Friend, it's got to be You and I. Off of Dirty Roses. Yeah. What a song. Just perfect pop. And he had that great sensibility about just writing in the standard keys as well, whereas Freddie was always writing in flats and minors and, you know, stand on your head chords coming in left, right and centre. Deke was very much about the DAG structure, you know, which is, you know, again, to put that into amongst all the Queen stuff that was also intricate and complicated, it had to be so good to warrant its position. And he was a king at writing that kind of pop stuff. I love it. So but Misfire is a good song. I like the Brian May guitars on it, the way he does that lovely sort of background of lush harmonies that just sit there sort of hooting along. That's really nice.
So just before we move on, I just wanted to share this quote from Mac, who would go on to produce Queen albums in the late 70s, as it's a great example of how John worked. He said, "John was an enigma. When Brian wrote, we knew, because he went one side to another with a notebook and sing us the choruses or telling us his ideas. When John Deacon wrote, we could tell because he hardly talked. He just stayed quiet for a long time, sitting in a chair and drinking tea and soda. I remember once Roger arrived, joking around to a living room we had in the studio. There was an absolute silence until Roger came in yelling, 'But what? Whose is the funeral?' And Freddie whispered to him, 'Shh, John's creating.'"
Fantastic.
You can just imagine that whole kind of scenario.
Definitely, sitting there pondering life I can imagine being very methodical and very, very on the money with it. You know, I think Brian was a cornucopia of crazy sort of guitar ideas and loads of things going on, and obviously Freddie was just completely out on a different planet as well. And Roger's probably just running around with a fag on and a guitar and just playing it really loudly and writing great songs. And yeah, I can imagine Deaky sitting there smoking a pipe with his slippers on. I'm going to compose a song now and it's going to be rather good. And out comes a guitar or electric piano and Bob's your auntie, you know. Good quote.
So we'll move on to Bring Back That Leroy Brown.
Yes.
So it's a Freddie Mercury composition that takes everything in a totally different direction. So when people talk about vaudeville in Queen, this is kind of the song that they're referencing.
Oh.
Is it a moment of genius or insanity?
It's everything. It's a moment of everything that's good about anything ever. I mean, this is a blueprint song for me, more than a lot of the Queen stuff. Bring Back Leroy Brown, for me, it's my ambition to write a song like that. And I'm going to do it. We've got Felix and the Golden Sun that's on the new Scarecrow album. And although it's very ELO, Jellyfish kind of based, all the way along, Bring Back That Leroy Brown is still the first point of reference that we use. It's like, you know, let's do a song that's a bit like this. Yeah, it's a bit like that Leroy Brown track off of Sheer Heart Attack. It always gets mentioned because it's got everything. It's got, I can't even to this day understand how they did that and make that song 2 minutes 20, whatever it is, long, and get all that information. And again, listen to the drums and the bass, the way they stop, start, and they're just like push and pulling you the whole time, and all these vocals are coming in left, right and centre, and then Roger's doing this high vocal, then there's the low vocal going on, and it's, you know, even if that was half the speed, that vocal would be a real feat to do. But to do it at that tempo, that tight, wow, it's one of the most glorious pieces of music I think I've ever heard, and it's a crazy song that hardly anybody references.
Drum Magazine praised Roger's drumming on this track, saying it really shows off Taylor's versatility. He nails dozens of kicks throughout this fast and tricky song and proves that he could have been a big band drummer or ably fit into any theatrical pit band if Queen hadn't worked out so well for him. A honky-tonk piano, upright bass, ukulele banjo and a smoking drummer all add up to a rollicking good time. I don't think you can really describe the song much better than that.
No, really. That's a perfect way of seeing it. I mean, again, when you look at the pieces of it, the way that it just moves from one bit to another, I mean, it's just, who thought of doing it like that? I mean, Freddie must have had such a knowledge of that kind of old school music. I mean, you know, dare I sort of put myself in the position where I would say, I'm going to go and write a song like that. I haven't got the knowledge without going and watching a lot of YouTube clips, which you can do now, obviously. But I mean, we have mentioned we are going to do ukulele on the next Cats album. Shouldn't probably say that at this stage in case I'm dropped by the management company, but we are going to explore it. I mean, Labby Siffrey, that It Must Be Love, which was Madness covered, that ukulele at beginning is, I just love it. I just love it when it's played that way, not the George Formby way, but the other way of playing ukulele. I really like it. I mean, Brian May does that thing on the middle bit, which is all done with the finger. And George Formby, when you watch his hands do this trill thing that he could do, not many people could do that. It's so fast. It's almost like Eddie Van Halen of the ukulele world. It's so quick. And Brian does that wonderful bit and that cascading piano that comes at the end of it. And it was just brilliantly put together. And the way the Chattanooga bit in the middle, do loo 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 loo, and that little hooty guitar, it's just amazing. It really is.
So we'll move on to She Makes Me, Stormtrooper and Stilettos. So this is Brian's lead vocal on the album. Now, this is one song on the album that seems to divide everyone who listens to it from what I've heard. I've heard it be called the worst song in Queen's entire back catalogue by some and a masterpiece by others. What side of the fence do you sit on?
Well, sack all the people that said the first one for a start. Where do they come from? What are they getting off on? How dare they?
I know.
It's, I mean, you know, again, Queen fans are loyal to themselves, each to their own. And, I mean, look at the whole of the Queen collection. To be honest, I could pick apart a few songs that I just will not listen to. You know, dare we not even go into the Hot Space territory, you know, it's all the works. You know, I'm not a fan of a lot of that stuff, but I really don't think you can pop it She Makes Me. I mean, from a musician point of view, when you look at how that song is constructed, and for a start, I thought it was Freddie singing it for many years because it's got that tone that is deceptively like Freddie. And it's got this the slow down drum sound. I mean, that's what they did pioneer on this album. I think they pioneered the huge drum sound, which came out in the 80s, where everyone wanted that massive bass drum and snare. if you listen to that, they're slowing this drum down. And I dare say Roger was going for a John Bonham type thing, obviously being a big influence. But I think the song is haunting, is a good way of describing it. It's very haunting, yeah. And don't really know what it's about. Don't understand why it's a stormtrooper in stilettos. I certainly didn't as an 11-year-old kid. I just love the way it rolls on. And of course, Brian's using the major 7 chord, which is always going to be a weakness for me, because I just love the major 7th chord. You know, it's the most uplifting chord there is for me, and he uses it in the verses. I think it's a fantastic song, and I think it creates a mood. I think it's a fantastic song, you know, and it's also one of the longest songs on the album, strangely enough. Yeah. I love it. I think it's a brilliant song.
So it's a particular highlight of the song is the soundscape at the end, what Brian May called New York nightmare sounds, including the police car sirens and the heavy breathing as the track comes to a close. Could that be a precursor to some of the soundtrack stuff that Queen would go on to do with Flash Gordon and Highlander, or perhaps even what Brian did for the French movie Furia in the 90s?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, again, these, you know, it wasn't that long, you know, until they started doing that kind of stuff. And, you know, these guys are so supremely talented. They were probably thinking all sorts of things way ahead before they even got the chance to do it. You know, they were, you know, I remember Brian May saying once in an interview, he said, we had a confidence about the band when we got together. He said it's like an unbridled confidence, matter of factness, that they weren't going to fail. He said if there's four of them that feel like that when they're together, that, you know, they are probably thinking way outside the box, way ahead of their time. I can see that. And, yeah, they're very intelligent people as well. They're very, you know, very thoughtful about what they're doing with their albums. As you can, as we've said many times, you know, it's, they put together wonderful soundscapes that work as a collective, you know, body for 40 minutes, you know, that you play from start to finish. And She Makes Me just sort of, after Leroy Brown, it just goes into this, you know, lovely sort of, like a precursor to the outro, which just works perfectly in the context of the album for me.
And we'll move on to In the Lap of the Gods Revisited, our final track on the album. With its sing-along chorus, it was almost designed for the stadiums that Queen would end up playing. Could this be where the seeds of songs like We Are the Champions comes from?
Absolutely. It's got to. They must have been thinking, that, you know, let's write an anthem, you know, but I love We Are the Champions. I mean, I've played it several hundred times, you know, in my theatre show. It ends our show every night. What a privilege it is to play We Are the Champions, you know, and pay the PRS to the rightful people. But for me, Lap of the Gods tops it, absolutely tops it. I mean, that wo wo la 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 hook line, for me, that's Queen. You know, Queen, in a nutshell, in 10 seconds, is wo wo la 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 wo. If I, you know, up until Bohemian Rhapsody, the single defining moment. It's just, as a song, it's just phenomenal. And I have several times blatantly used it for reference, which many people might realise that, but I just love it. I just love the chord structure and that massive hook. I mean, I'd love to write a song that could go whoa and not have any words in it, but the trouble is, the minute you do that, everyone goes, that's Lap of the Gods, that is. You know, it's brilliant.
And we talked during In the Lap of the Gods earlier on in the album how the studio techniques used could be seen as a precursor to, like, Bohemian Rhapsody. In your mind, is Revisited a companion song to its namesake, or are they just unrelated songs that just share a cool name?
I think it does link in. I think when you listen to it now, I think you can definitely see that it's meant to be that way, yeah. I mean, yeah, I think that, you know, from a lyrical point of view, they've tied it in, you know, by using the words and stuff. But, I think it just, sort of dovetails side two of the album, you know, in that way, where it starts with this ridiculous horror frightening piece of music called Lap of the Gods, you know, leave it in the lap of the gods, and then it's like, well, at the end they go revisit it, and then I think it's an incredible piece of high drama, you know, it's pure theater to me, and that's how music should be.
Yeah, I mean, if I was forced to choose, this would be my favorite song on the album, and I think we were talking about potential other singles for the album, this, I think this would have made a great single. The band resurrected the song live on the Magic Tour in 1986, as well as their most recent tour with Adam Lambert. And I saw them with Adam Lambert in Newcastle, and I was so excited to hear them perform this song. Why do you think that the song's endured so much with Queen's strong army of fans, in spite of never really being a hit?
I think it's because anyone that's a proper Queen fan and can go back that far with them will remember watching the whistle test on telly and watching the sea of dry ice and people waving and that song finishing the gig and the explosion going off. And that, when you're 11, 12 years old, sticks in the memory banks forever. It's just a defining moment for me, and it always has been. You know, when they did it in 86, I couldn't believe that he started doing it. As I said, well, that's just taken the whole gig. Anything else doesn't matter now. That's it. The gig's done. And they did it so early on, that was it. It was game over for me. All the stuff that came after it was nonsense. You know, because I wasn't a big fan of the Wembley era. But to stick Lap of the Gods in was just like, oh, that's what you used to be, dare I say it. And the Adam Lambert, when he sang it, I went cold, absolutely frozen to the spot, watching one of the best things I've ever seen. My girlfriend's actually squealed. She actually squealed like a giddy girl when he came out, that good-looking dude, and he started singing this song. And we just stood there, mesmerised by it. And everyone comes, come on in, what do you think? Then I know, you know, Freddie's not there, come on in, I know you're going to slag it off. And I said, I've just seen possibly the best gig I've ever seen. And I don't say that lightly, because I have seen him with Freddie. And his vocals were staggeringly good. And he does Freddie proud, you know, and it's just, he's not Freddie, no one's Freddie, leave it where it is, you know, blah, blah, blah. But as a show and a spectacle and giving value for money and playing those songs, Adam Lambert's the only man for the job.
So, it's the album that kickstarted Queen's road to immortality. Ultimate Classic Rock had this to say about Sheer Heart Attack as a whole. Ultimately, Sheer Heart Attack was both schizophrenic and of peace. It set the adventurous template that seduced fans and then kept them on their toes every time a new Queen album landed on record store racks, bearing astonishing gifts of outlandish imagination and brilliant songcraft. As time went by, future Queen albums boasted bigger hits and even more consistent material. Sheer Heart Attack crystallised their inimitable style. However, even as it showed the way forward for the band, they never looked back. With that in mind, how does Sheer Heart Attack stand the test of time for you?
It's timeless. As to be honest, the first six Queen albums and probably News of the World, they all are. As I said at the beginning, it's, you know, for me to bang on about Sheer Heart Attack at great length, which I'm hopefully everyone's entertained by that, but you're talking about a band that did these albums of equal incredibleness. You know, it's, I only picked Sheer Heart Attack purely because of the age I was when I heard it, how influential it was going to become as I got older. You know, not so much the immediate, because once Thin Lizzy came out, I became a Thin Lizzy fan like no other. You know, I mean, they are dyed, you know, in my skin, you know, Lizzy are. But Queen just seemed to have something about them. There's that timeless quality, and it's nothing to do with, you know, looking back and saying, oh, yeah, Bohemian Rhapsody. It's Sheer Heart Attack was before Bo Rap. You know, March of the Black Queen was before Bo Rap. I think Night of the Opera and Out of the Races were just continuations of, you know, the greatest band ever. But Sheer Heart Attack was definitely where it all really, you know, put the marker down for me. So that classic rock write-up is absolutely spot on, I think.
So, finally, why is Sheer Heart Attack your classic album? And why should people check it out?
Pretty much what I just said, really. It's just, it's a band that had crystallised what they were doing to that point, and they put this marker down that they were going to become, you know, a band that, like no other, like a band that no one's ever seen. You know, even to the point of, the, you know, just the sleeve with the four of them on it, a very basic font that says Queen Sheer Heart Attack. It just smacks you in the face. And yet, when you put the album on, although they call it their rock album, it's got all the elements of everything Queen ever did and have ever done all on one album. And I don't think they ever really explored the boundaries quite as far. They did it on Night of the Opera, you could argue, but I still think, for me, Sheer Heart Attack as a consistent piece of music from start to finish is still just about the kiddie for me.
So before I let you go, and thank you very much for taking the time to chat about one of my favourite albums, and obviously one of yours too, I know that Cats in Space have a new album out. Scarecrow is coming out very soon, isn't it?
We have indeed, and it's better than Sheer Heart Attack.
Well, maybe one day we'll do Scarecrow on my classic album.
I like to think that on Scarecrow we're going to take you on a further journey than we've done Too Many Gods. It's, again, it's all what we said about Sheer Heart Attack, all those ideas, and I just want to bring a little bit of that back to the table in 2017 with what Cats in Space is all about. We're a band that produce an album from start to finish. It's not designed to be shuffled. It's designed to be listened to. Look at the gatefold sleeve, look at the lyrics, you know, do whatever you want to do while you're listening to it. But taking you back to those sort of glory days when Queen were doing albums like it, and if we've got that tiny little chink of Queen's talent hidden in our armory, then I'll die a very happy man. But yeah, I'm very, very, very proud of Scarecrow. The reviews are astonishing so far. I mean, I can't quite, you know, get my breath. They are absolutely gone nuts over it, and we're very, very excited. And obviously, we're touring in September throughout the UK, and we're going to be doing some more stuff later in the year as well. And yeah, Cats in Space have well and truly landed, and Scarecrow is a continuation of over-the-top, pompous 70s-style rock that I think is sadly missing in this day and age. So we intend to bring it to the masses.
Yeah, and I mean, I know, I mean, I absolutely love the first album, absolutely phenomenal. And I know that next time you get yourselves up to Newcastle, I'll definitely be coming along
absolutely.
And check out the shows.
Yeah. Well, you're going to love the second album, Mike. It's, I hope that a good man like yourself will definitely peel the layers away, and you'll see a little bit of what we've been talking about today with Sheer Heart Attack, because it's very much the blueprint for me. You know, you've got to throw the doors open and just not be afraid to be a bit adventurous. And we're not, you know, we're not a rock band per se. We're not a pop band. We're not AOR. We are just sort of a rock band that isn't frightened to push the doors open and walk down those hallowed sort of paths that Queen forged back in the 70s. You know, it's still my blueprint for everything that I do. And if people like me, you know, doing it in the way that we do it, and me and Mick writing the songs the way we do, and my, you know, all the amazing guys in the band who are all phenomenal players. I mean, Stevie Bacon is a huge Roger Taylor fan. Jeff Brown is an incredible singer and bass player that plays like John Deacon one minute and, you know, like Phil Lynott the next or whatever. And he can do a great, you know, oh, he did a tour de force. And of course, you've got Andy Stewart on keyboards, who is classically trained. So he does all the Freddie stuff. And we've got Dean Howard, who's just the most amazing guitar player that just is so cool. And then, of course, we've got the Manzi. We've got the Manzi on vocals, who is just one of the best singers I've ever heard. And we're so lucky to have him. He's an amazing singer. And he is the icing on the cake that allows us to do what Cats in Space does, you know, and we're having a hell of a good time doing it.
Well, Greg, thank you very much for taking the time out to chat with me about Sheer Heart Attack, and good luck with Scarecrow.
Thank you very much, and it's been an absolute joy talking about one of the greatest albums ever.
A huge thanks to Greg Hart for taking time out of a very busy schedule to sit down with me and chat about Sheer Heart Attack, which I actually think is probably, in that kind of classic period of Queen albums, one of the most underrated. People talk about A Night at the Opera and News of the World a lot, and I think that it's nice that Sheer Heart Attack is getting a bit of love today. But I would say that because it's my favourite Queen album. So, Cats in Space are absolutely awesome. I'm just going to throw that in there straight away. If you like that early Queen sound, kind of Queen 2, Sheer Heart Attack, you will love Cats in Space. They are totally your thing. So, Cats in Space's new album, Scarecrow, is out now. And, you know, it's cool when I was listening to it. It just reminded me of that kind of early 70s vibe. It is such a cool album. But if you want to see them live, you can actually get the chance this month. So they're touring, get this lineup. Deep Purple are headlining, Europe and Cats in Space are opening. Like, I'm gutted that they're not coming to the Northeast, because that's an absolutely amazing lineup. So it's Deep Purple's Long Goodbye Tour with Europe and Cats in Space. They'll be playing the Birmingham Barclaycard Arena on the 17th of November, Manchester Arena on the 18th, Cardiff's Motorpoint Arena on the 20th, Glasgow's SSE Hydro on the 22nd, and the O2 in London on the 23rd. So get yourself to your relevant ticketing places to see not only the legendary Deep Purple and Europe, who I've seen live once and they were absolutely awesome, but Cats in Space. That's a hell of a show. And if anyone goes, please let me know what it was like, because I would love to have gone to that show. It sounds like it'd be an awesome night. So that is it for another episode of My Classic Album. Thank you so much for joining me. If you enjoyed it, I would be over the moon if you could put a nice rating or a review wherever you've listened to it, be it Apple Podcasts or wherever. Don't forget that you can keep in touch with the show and just find out what's going on our Facebook page, My Classic Album with Mike Norris. You can follow us on Instagram, My Classic Album Podcast, or you can follow us on Twitter, MCA_podcast. And of course, all this information and everything you need to know about the podcast is over at myclassicalbum.co.uk. Our next episode, of course, will be on December 1st. I'm keeping the next album for next month a little close to my chest at the minute, just while you all start voting for 2017's My Classic Album of the Year. But keep an eye out on those social media pages, and I will be revealing the album and my special guest in the next week or so. I've been speaking with quite a lot of people as well, so there's some really cool guests and some really cool albums coming up in the new year. So again, keep your eye out on those pages and you should be the first to hear all about it. But in the meantime, have a great month and I'll see you in December. Cheers!